Chapter 13. Edit. The Invisible Art. I saw the angel in the marble, and carved until I set him free. Michelangelo. Every year at the Academy Awards, the most notable prize is for Best Picture. The media speculate on it for weeks prior to the broadcast, and most viewers stay up well past their bedtimes to see it awarded. There is a far less hyped award on the night, the one for film editing. Let's face it, most viewers flip the channel or go into the kitchen to refill their popcorn bowl when the winner of Best Film Editing is announced. Yet what most people don't know is that the two awards are highly correlated. Since 1981, not a single film has won Best Picture without at least being nominated for film editing. In fact, in about two-thirds of the cases, the movie nominated for film editing has gone on to win Best Picture. In the history of the Academy Awards, the most respected, if not exactly celebrated, film editor is Michael Caine. With 8 nominations, more than anyone else in the business, and 3 wins under his belt. While his is hardly a household name, the films he has edited certainly are. He is the editor of such notable films as Saving Private Ryan, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Schindler's List, and Lincoln. Indeed, over 37 years he has edited almost all of Steven Spielberg's movies, becoming his right-hand man in the process. Yet only a handful of people know Caine's name. It is for good reason that film editing is sometimes known as the invisible art. Clearly, editing, which involves the strict elimination of the trivial, unimportant, or irrelevant, is an essentialist craft. So what makes a good editor? When the editing branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences sit down to select their nominees for film editing, they try, as Mark Harris has written, very hard not to look at what they're supposed to be looking at. In other words, a good film editor makes it hard not to see what's important because she eliminates everything but the elements that absolutely need to be there. In Chapter 6, we likened exploring to being a journalist. It involves asking questions, listening, and connecting the dots in order to distinguish the essential few from the trivial many. So it makes sense that the next stage in the essentialist process, eliminating the non-essentials, means taking on the role of an editor in your life and leadership. Jack Dorsey is best known as the creator of Twitter and as the founder and CEO of Square, a mobile payments company. His essentialist approach to management is a relatively rare one. At a dinner I attended recently where he spoke, he said he thinks of the role of CEO as being the chief editor of the company. At another event at Stanford, he explained further, "By editorial, I mean there are 1,000 things we could be doing, but there are only 1 or 2 that are important. And all of these ideas and inputs from engineers, support people, designers, are going to constantly flood what we should be doing. As an editor, I am constantly taking these inputs and deciding the one, or intersection of a few, that makes sense for what we are doing." An editor is not merely someone who says no to things. A 3-year-old can do that. Nor does an editor simply eliminate. In fact, in a way, an editor actually adds. What I mean is that a good editor is someone who uses deliberate subtraction to actually add life to the ideas, setting, plot, and characters. Likewise in life, disciplined editing can help add to your level of contribution. It increases your ability to focus on and give energy to the things that really matter. It lends the most meaningful relationships and activities more space to blossom. Editing aids the effortless execution of the essentialist by removing anything distracting or unnecessary or awkward. Or as one book editor put it, "My job is to make life as effortless as possible for the reader. The goal is to help the reader have the clearest possible understanding of the most important message or takeaway." Of course, editing also involves making trade-offs. Instead of trying to fit it all in, every character, every plot twist, every detail, an editor asks, "Will this character or plot twist or detail make it better?" For an author, whether of films, books, or journalism, it is easy to get overly committed to a certain idea or body of work, especially one you slaved over. It can be quite painful to eliminate passages, pages, or even chapters that took weeks, months, maybe even years to write in the first place. Yet such disciplined elimination is critical to the craft. You must, as Stephen King has said, kill your darlings, even when it breaks your egocentric little scribbler's heart, kill your darlings. A non-essentialist thinks that making things better means adding something. An essentialist thinks that making things better means subtracting something. A non-essentialist is attached to every word, image, or detail. An essentialist eliminates the distracting words, images, and details. Of course, editing a film or a book or any other creative work is not the same as editing your life. In life, we don't have the luxury of revisiting a conversation we have just had, or a meeting we just led, or a presentation we just made and reworking it, red pen in hand. Nevertheless, four simple principles inherent in editing do apply to editing the non-essentials out of our lives. Editing life. Cut out options. To state the obvious, editing involves cutting out things that confuse the reader and cloud the message or story. It is a matter of record that well-edited movies and books are easy on the eye and the brain. When making decisions, deciding to cut options can be terrifying, but the truth is, it is the very essence of decision-making. In fact, the Latin root of the word decision, cis or sid, literally means to cut or to kill. You can see this in words like scissors, homicide, or fratricide. Since ultimately having fewer options actually makes a decision easier on the eye and the brain, we must summon the discipline to get rid of options or activities that may be good, or even really good, but that get in the way. Yes, making the choice to eliminate something good can be painful. But eventually, every cut produces joy. Maybe not in the moment, but afterwards, when we realize that every additional moment we have gained can be spent on something better. That may be one reason why Stephen King has written, "To write is human, to edit is divine." Condense. Many people have been credited with coming up with this apt sentiment. I must apologize. If I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. It's true that doing less can be harder, both in art and in life. Every word, every scene, every activity must count for more. An editor is ruthless in the pursuit of making every word count. Instead of saying it in two sentences, can you say it in one? Is it possible to use one word where two are currently being used? As Alan D. Williams observed in the essay, What is an Editor?, there are two basic questions the editor should be addressing to the author. Are you saying what you want to say? And are you saying it as clearly and concisely as possible? Condensing means saying it as clearly and concisely as possible. Likewise, in life, condensing allows us to do more with less. For example, when Graham Hill moved into a 420-square-foot apartment in New York, he wanted to see how well he could condense everything he owned. The ultimate result was a design he called a little jewel box. The jewel box works because every piece of furniture has multiple functions. The wall on the left of the picture, for example, acts as a large projector screen for watching movies and also houses two guest beds that can be pulled out when visitors come to stay. The wall to the right folds down over the couch to reveal a queen bed. Everything does double or triple duty. In other words, everything makes a greater contribution to apartment life. This design turned out to be so innovative that he turned it into a business devoted to the art of getting more out of less space. He named it appropriately lifeedited.com. But to be clear, condensing doesn't mean doing more at once. It simply means less waste. It means lowering the ratio of words to ideas, square feet to usefulness, or effort to results. Thus, to apply the principle of condensing to our lives, we need to shift the ratio of activities to meaning. We need to eliminate multiple meaningless activities and replace them with one very meaningful activity. For example, one employee at a company I've worked with, one who was well enough established to not have to worry about being fired, routinely skipped the weekly meeting other people attended and would simply ask them what he had missed. Thus, he condensed a 2-hour meeting into 10 minutes and invested the rest of that redeemed time getting the important work done. Correct. An editor's job is not just to cut or condense, but also to make something right. It can be a change as minor as a grammar correction or as involved as fixing the flaws in an argument. To do this well, an editor must have a clear sense of the overarching purpose of the work he or she is editing. As Michael Kahn explains, he doesn't always do what Spielberg tells him to do. Instead, he does what he thinks Spielberg really wants. Understanding the overarching intent allows him to make the corrections that even Spielberg himself might not be able to verbalize. Similarly, in our own professional or private lives, we can make course corrections by coming back to our core purpose. Having a clear overarching intent, as discussed in Chapter 10, enables us to check ourselves, to regularly compare our activities or behaviors to our real intent. If they are incorrect, we can edit them. Edit less. This may seem a little counterintuitive, but the best editors don't feel the need to change everything. They know that sometimes having the discipline to leave certain things exactly as they are is the best use of their editorial judgment. It is just one more way in which being an editor is an invisible craft. The best surgeon is not the one who makes the most incisions. Similarly, the best editors can sometimes be the least intrusive, the most restrained. Becoming an editor in our lives also includes knowing when to show restraint. One way we can do this is by editing our tendency to step in. When we are added onto an email thread, for example, we can resist our usual temptation to be the first to reply all. When sitting in a meeting, we can resist the urge to add our 2 cents. We can wait. We can observe. We can see how things develop. Doing less is not just a powerful essentialist strategy, it's a powerful editorial one as well. A non-essentialist views editing as a discrete task to be performed only when things become overwhelming. But waiting too long to edit will force us to make major cuts not always of our choosing. Editing our time and activities continuously allows us to make more minor but deliberate adjustments along the way. Becoming an essentialist means making cutting, condensing, and correcting a natural part of our daily routine, making editing a natural cadence in our lives. Chapter 14. Limit. The freedom of setting boundaries. No is a complete sentence. Anne Lamott. Jin Young was an employee at a technology company in Korea who found herself planning her wedding while simultaneously preparing for a board meeting that was to take place 3 weeks prior to her big day. When her manager, Hayori, asked Jin Young to create the script and all the slides for their joint presentation at the board meeting, Jin Young put in several 15-hour days and completed the work quickly so she could devote the days leading up to the board meeting to planning her wedding. Her manager was surprised and delighted that the work was done ahead of schedule, and Jin Young was now free to immerse herself in 5 uninterrupted days of wedding planning. Then Jin Young received an urgent request from her manager asking her to complete an additional project prior to the board meeting. In their several years of working together, Jin Young had never told Hayori no, even when saying yes threw her life into temporary turmoil, as it often did. Up to this point, Jin Young had given unknowable hours to executing every request and task and delivering them in neat and complete packages, no matter the sacrifice. This time, however, she did not hesitate, and she told her manager no. She chose not to apologize or over-justify her answer. She simply said, "I have planned for this time, I have worked hard for it, and I deserved to have it, guilt-free." Then something shocking happened. Everyone else on the team said no, and Hayori, the manager, was left to complete the task on her own. At first, Hayori was fuming. It had taken her all week to complete the task, and she wasn't happy about it. But after laboring over the task for days, she saw all sorts of flaws in the way she'd been doing things. She soon realized that if she wanted to be a more effective manager, she needed to pull in the reins and get clear with each member of the team about expectations, accountability, and outcomes. In the end, she was grateful to Jin Young for helping her see the error of her ways. By establishing boundaries, Jin Young not only opened her manager's eyes to unhealthy team dynamics and opened up a space for change, she did it in a way that earned her abiding gratitude and respect. The disappearance of boundaries is typical of our non-essentialist era. For one thing, of course, technology has completely blurred the lines between work and family. These days, there don't seem to be any boundaries at all regarding when people expect us to be available to work. I recently had an executive assistant provide me with times for a client meeting that included Saturday morning, even though there was no particular urgency for the meeting and no acknowledgement that Saturday was an unusual day to offer. Has Saturday become the new Friday, I wondered? But what most people don't realize is that the problem is not just that the boundaries have been blurred, it's that the boundary of work has edged insidiously into family territory. It is hard to imagine executives in most companies who would be comfortable with employees bringing their children to work on Monday morning, yet they seem to have no problem expecting their employees to come into the office or to work on a project on a Saturday or Sunday. Clayton Christensen, the Harvard business professor and author of The Innovator's Dilemma, was once asked to make just such a sacrifice. At the time, he was working at a management consulting firm, and one of the partners came to him and told him he needed to come in on Saturday to help work on a project. Clay simply responded, "Oh, I am so sorry. I have made the commitment that every Saturday is a day to be with my wife and children." The partner, displeased, stormed off. But later he returned and he said, "Clay, fine. I have talked with everyone on the team and they said they will come in on Sunday instead. So I will expect you to be there." Clay sighed and said, "I appreciate you trying to do that, but Sunday will not work. I have given Sunday to God, and so I won't be able to come in." If the partner was frustrated before, he was much more so now. Still, Clay was not fired for standing his ground, and while his choice was not popular in the moment, ultimately he was respected for it. The boundaries paid off. Clay recalls, "That taught me an important lesson. If I had made an exception then, I might have made it many times." Boundaries are a little like the walls of a sandcastle. The second we let one fall over, the rest of them come crashing down. I won't deny that setting boundaries can be hard. Just because it worked out for Jin Young and Clay doesn't mean it always does. Jin Young could have lost the job opportunity. Clay's unwillingness to work on weekends could have limited his career. It's true that boundaries can come at a high price. However, not pushing back costs more. Our ability to choose what is most essential in life. For Jin Young and Clay, respect in the workplace and time for God and family were most important. So these were the things they deliberately and strategically chose to prioritize. After all, if you don't set boundaries, there won't be any. Or even worse, there will be boundaries, but they'll be set by default or by another person instead of by design. Non-essentialists tend to think of boundaries as constraints or limits, things that get in the way of their hyper-productive life. To a non-essentialist, setting boundaries is evidence of weakness. If they are strong enough, they think they don't need boundaries. They can cope with it all. They can do it all. But without limits, they eventually become spread so thin that getting anything done becomes virtually impossible. Essentialists, on the other hand, see boundaries as empowering. They recognize that boundaries protect their time from being hijacked and often free them from the burden of having to say no to things that further others' objectives instead of their own. They know that clear boundaries allow them to proactively eliminate the demands and encumbrances from others that distract them from the true essentials. A non-essentialist thinks if you have limits, you will be limited. An essentialist knows that if you have limits, you will become limitless. A non-essentialist sees boundaries as constraining. an essentialist sees boundaries as liberating. A non-essentialist exerts effort attempting the direct no. An essentialist sets rules in advance that eliminate the need for the direct no. Their problem is not your problem. Of course, the challenge of setting boundaries goes far beyond the workplace. In our personal lives, too, there are some people who seem to know no boundaries when they make demands on our time. How often do you feel your Saturday or Sunday is being hijacked by someone else's agenda? Is there someone in your personal life who doesn't seem to sense when he or she is crossing the line? We all have some people in our lives who tend to be higher maintenance for us than others. These are the people who make their problem our problem. They distract us from our purpose. They care only about their own agendas, and if we let them, they prevent us from making our highest level of contribution by siphoning our time and energy off to activities that are essential to them rather than those that are essential to us. So how do we take a page from Jin Young and Clayton Christensen and set the kinds of boundaries that will protect us from other people's agendas? Following are several guidelines for your consideration. Don't rob people of their problems. I am not saying we should never help people. We should serve and love and make a difference in the lives of others, of course. But when people make their problem our problem, we aren't helping them. We're enabling them. Once we take their problem for them, all we're doing is taking away their ability to solve it. The author Henry Cloud tells a story about just this kind of situation in his book Boundaries. Once, the parents of a 25-year-old man came to see him. They wanted him to fix their son. He asked them why they had come without their son, and they said, well, he doesn't think he has a problem. After listening to their story, Henry concluded, to their surprise, I think your son is right. He doesn't have a problem, you do. You pay, you fret, you worry, you plan, you exert energy to keep him going. He doesn't have a problem because you have taken it from him. Cloud then offered them a metaphor. Imagine a neighbor who never waters his lawn. But whenever you turn on your sprinkler system, the water falls on his lawn. Your grass is turning brown and dying, but Bill looks down at his green grass and thinks to himself, my yard is doing fine. Thus everyone loses. Your efforts have been wasted, and Bill never develops the habit of watering his own lawn. The solution? As Cloud puts it, you need some fences to keep his problems out of your yard and in his, where they belong. In the working world, people try to use our sprinklers to water their own grass all the time. This may come in the form of a boss who puts you on a committee for her pet project, a colleague who asks for your input on a report or presentation or proposal she hasn't taken the time to perfect yet herself, or a colleague who stops you in the hallway and talks your ear off when you have an important meeting to get to, or a vital phone call to make, or critical work on your desk. Whoever it is that's trying to siphon off your time and energies for their own purpose, the only solution is to put up fences. And not at the moment the request is made. You need to put up your fences well in advance, clearly demarcating what's off limits so you can head off the time wasters and boundary pushers at the pass. Remember, forcing these people to solve their own problems is equally beneficial for you and for them. Boundaries are a source of liberation. This truth is demonstrated elegantly by the story of a school located next to a busy road. At first, the children played only on a small swath of the playground, close to the building where the grown-ups could keep their eyes on them. But then someone constructed a fence around the playground. Now the children were able to play anywhere and everywhere on the playground. Their freedom, in effect, more than doubled. Similarly, when we don't set clear boundaries in our lives, we can end up imprisoned by the limits others have set for us. When we have clear boundaries, on the other hand, we are free to select from the whole area or the whole range of options that we have deliberately chosen to explore. Find your deal breakers. When I ask executives to identify their boundaries, they can rarely do it. They know they have some, but they cannot put them into words. The simple reality is, if you can't articulate these to yourself and others, it may be unrealistic to expect other people to respect them or even figure them out. Think of one person who frequently pulls you off your most essential path. Make a list of your deal breakers the types of requests or activities from that person that you simply refuse to say yes to unless they somehow overlap with your own priorities or agenda. Another quick test for finding your deal breakers is to write down any time you feel violated or put upon by someone's request. It doesn't have to be in some extreme way for you to notice it. Even a small pinch, to use a description I think is helpful for describing a minor violation of your boundaries, that makes you feel even a twinge of resentment, whether it's an unwanted invitation, an unsolicited opportunity, or a request for a small favor, is a clue for discovering your own hidden boundaries. Craft social contracts. I was once paired with a colleague who approached projects in a completely opposite way. People predicted there would be fireworks between us, but our working relationship was actually quite harmonious. Why? Because when we first got together, I made it a point to lay out my priorities and what extra work I would and wouldn't be willing to take on over the lifespan of the project. "Let's just agree on what we want to achieve," I began. "Here are a couple of things that really matter to me," and I asked him to do the same. Thus we worked through a social contract, not unlike the one Jin Young and her boss worked out in the opening story of this chapter. Simply having an understanding up front about what we were really trying to achieve and what our boundaries were kept us from wasting each other's time, saddling each other with burdensome requests, and distracting each other from the things that were essential to us. As a result, we were each able to make our highest level of contribution on the project, and we got along famously despite our differences throughout the process. With practice, enforcing your limits will become easier and easier. Execute. How to make execution effortless. There are two ways of thinking about execution. While non-essentialists tend to force execution, essentialists invest the time they have saved by eliminating the non-essentials into designing a system to make execution almost effortless. In Chapter 1, we talked about how our life can resemble an overly full closet, and how an essentialist would approach organizing it. We talked about how, if you want your closet to stay tidy, you need a regular routine. You need to have one large bag for items you need to throw away, and a very small pile for items you want to keep. You need to know the drop-off location and the hours of your local thrift store. You need to have a scheduled time to go there. In other words, once you've figured out which activities and efforts to keep in your life, you have to have a system for executing them. You can't wait until that closet is bursting at the seams and then take superhuman efforts to purge it. You have to have a system in place so that keeping it neat becomes routine and effortless. It is human nature to want to do easy things. In this part of the book, you'll learn how to make executing the right things, the essential things, as easy and frictionless as possible. Chapter 15. Buffer. The unfair advantage. Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first 4 sharpening the axe. Attributed to Abraham Lincoln. In the Hebrew Bible, a story is told of Joseph, of amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat fame, who saved Egypt from a savage 7-year famine. The Pharaoh had a dream he could not interpret and asked his wisest advisers to explain it correctly to him. They couldn't interpret it either, but someone remembered that Joseph, who was in prison at the time, had a reputation for explaining the meaning of dreams, and thus he was called for. In the dream, Pharaoh was standing by a river when he saw 7 fat-fleshed kine, or cows, come out of the water and feed in a meadow. Then 7 others came out that were lean-fleshed. The second set of cows ate the first set. Joseph explained that the dream meant there would be 7 years of plenty in Egypt and then 7 years of famine. Therefore, Joseph suggested that the Pharaoh appoint someone discreet and wise to take a fifth of the harvest every year for 7 years and store it as a buffer for the years of famine. The plan was approved, and Joseph was given the position of vizier, or second in command over Egypt. He executed the plan perfectly so that when the 7 years of famine arrived, everyone in Egypt and the surrounding areas, including Joseph's extended family, was saved. In this simple story is one of the most powerful practices essentialists employ to ensure effortless execution. The reality is we live in an unpredictable world. Even apart from extreme events, such as famines, we face the unexpected constantly. We do not know whether the traffic will be clear or congested. We do not know if our flight will be delayed or cancelled. We do not know if we'll slip on a slick road tomorrow and break our wrist. Similarly, in the workplace, we do not know if a supplier will be late, or a colleague will drop the ball, or a client will change his or her directions at the 11th hour, and so on. The only thing we can expect with any great certainty is the unexpected. Therefore, we can either wait for the moment and react to it, or we can prepare. We can create a buffer. A buffer can be defined literally as something that prevents two things from coming into contact and harming each other. For example, a buffer zone at the periphery of a protected environmental area is an area of land that is used to create extra space between that area and any potential threats that might infiltrate it. On one occasion, I was trying to explain the concept of buffers to my children. We were in the car together at the time, and I tried to explain the idea using a game. Imagine, I said, that we had to get to our destination 3 miles away without stopping. Almost at once, the children could see the challenge. We couldn't predict what was going to happen in front of us and around us. We didn't know how long the light would stay on green, or if the car in front would suddenly swerve or put on its brakes. The only way to keep from crashing was to put extra space between our car and the car in front of us. This space acted as a buffer. It gave us time to respond and adapt to any sudden or unexpected moves by other cars. It allowed us to avoid the friction of violent stops and starts. Similarly, we can reduce the friction of executing the essential in our work and lives simply by creating a buffer. During the car game with my children, they noticed that when I got distracted talking and laughing, I would forget the buffer zone and get too close to the car in front of us. Then I would have to do something unnatural, like swerve or slam on the brakes at the last second to adjust. A similar thing can happen if we forget to respect and maintain buffers in our lives. We get busy and distracted, and before we know it, the project is due. The day of the big presentation has arrived, no matter how much extra time we built in. As a result, we are forced to swerve or slam on the brakes at the last minute. From chemistry, we know that gases expand to fill the space they are in. Similarly, we've all experienced how projects and commitments tend to expand, despite our best efforts, to fill the amount of time allotted to them. Just think of how often this happens in presentations, meetings, and workshops you have attended. How many times have you seen someone try to fit too many slides into too little time? How many times have you been to a conference where you felt that the presenter cut off a meaningful conversation because of feeling obliged to get through all the content he or she had planned? I have seen this so often, it has started to seem the default position. So when I worked with a facilitator who had a different philosophy, it was truly liberating. He was designing a 4-hour workshop. But instead of allowing the typical 10 minutes at the end of the session for questions and comments, he suggested a full hour. He explained, "I like to allow a luxurious amount of time, just in case things come up." At first, his idea was dismissed as indulgent, and he was instructed to go back to the traditional format. Sure enough, the class ran over its allotted time, and the facilitator had to try to rush through the remaining content. So the class was changed to allow the hour originally suggested. Things came up as he had expected, but this time there was a buffer built in. Now the class could end on time and the facilitator could focus on teaching rather than rushing. A mother I know learned a similar lesson when preparing to go on a holiday with her family. In the past, when they went on vacation, she would leave the packing until the night before. Inevitably, she would end up staying up late, losing steam, getting too little sleep, finishing the packing in the morning, forgetting something, leaving late, and having to push through the long drive to compensate. This time, however, she started packing a week in advance. She made certain the car was fully packed the night before, so that in the morning the only thing she had to do was wake up the children and get everyone in the car. It worked. They got off early, with a good night's sleep, nothing was forgotten, and when they hit traffic it wasn't stressful because they had a buffer for that possibility. As a result, they not only arrived on time, but enjoyed a frictionless and even pleasant journey. The non-essentialist tends to always assume a best-case scenario. We all know those people, and many of us, myself included, have been that person, who chronically underestimate how long something will really take. This will just take 5 minutes, or I'll be finished with that project by Friday, or it will only take me a year to write my magnum opus. Yet, inevitably, these things take longer. Something unexpected comes up, or the task ends up being more involved than anticipated, or the estimate was simply too optimistic in the first place. When this happens, they are left reacting to the problem. The results inevitably suffer. Perhaps they pull an all-nighter to make it happen. Perhaps they cut corners, hand in an incomplete project, or worse, fail to get it done at all. Or perhaps they leave someone else on the team to pick up the slack. Either way, they fail to execute at their highest level. The way of the essentialist is different. The essentialist looks ahead. She plans. She prepares for different contingencies. She expects the unexpected. She creates a buffer to prepare for the unforeseen, thus giving herself some wiggle room when things come up, as they inevitably do. A non-essentialist assumes the best-case scenario will happen. An essentialist builds in a buffer for unexpected events. A non-essentialist forces execution at the last minute. An essentialist practices extreme and early preparation. When a non-essentialist receives a windfall, she tends to consume it rather than to set it aside for a rainy day. We can see an example of this in the way nations have responded to finding oil. For example, in 1980, when Britain discovered North Sea oil, the government suddenly had a massive windfall in additional tax revenues, to the tune of £166 billion, $250 billion, over a decade. Arguments can be made for and against how this money was used. But what is beyond contestation is that it was used. Instead of creating an endowment to prepare against unexpected disasters, such as, in hindsight, the coming Great Recession, the British government spent it in other ways. The way of the essentialist, on the other hand, is to use the good times to create a buffer for the bad. Norway also benefited enormously from windfall taxes from oil, but unlike Britain, Norway invested much of its good fortune in an endowment. Today, this endowment has grown over time to be worth an extraordinary $720 billion, making it the world's largest sovereign wealth fund and providing a cushion against unknown future scenarios. These days, the pace of our lives is only getting faster and faster. It is as if we are driving 1 inch behind another car at 100 miles an hour. If that driver makes even the tiniest unexpected move, if he slows down even a little, or swerves even the smallest bit, we'll ram right into him. There is no room for error. As a result, execution is often highly stressful, frustrating, and forced. Following are a few tips for keeping your work and sanity from swerving off the road by creating a buffer. Use extreme preparation. When I was a graduate student at Stanford, I learned the key to receiving top grades was extreme preparation. The moment we received the syllabi for our classes, I would make copies of them and paste together a calendar for the whole semester. Even before the first day of class, I knew what the big projects were and would start on them immediately. This small investment in preparation reduced the stress of the entire semester because I knew I had plenty of time to get all the assignments done, even if my workload suddenly got heavy, or if a family emergency forced me to miss some classes, or if any other unexpected event should happen. The value of extreme preparation on a grander scale can be seen in the story of Roald Amundsen and Robert Falcon Scott in their race to be the first people in modern history to reach the South Pole. Both men had exactly the same objective, but their approaches differed. Amundsen prepared for anything and everything that could possibly go wrong. Scott hoped for the best-case scenario. He brought just one thermometer for the trip and was furious when it broke. Amundsen brought four thermometers. Scott stored 1 ton of food for his 17 men. Amundsen stored 3 tons. Scott stashed supplies for the return journey in one spot, marked with a single flag, meaning that if he went even a fraction off course, his team could miss it. Amundsen, by contrast, planted 20 markers miles apart to ensure that his team would see them. Roald Amundsen prepared diligently and read obsessively for his journey, whereas Robert Falcon Scott did the bare minimum. While Amundsen deliberately built slack and buffers into his plan, Scott hoped for the ideal circumstances. While Scott's men suffered from fatigue, hunger, and frostbite, Amundsen's team's journey was relatively, under the circumstances, frictionless. Amundsen successfully made the journey. Scott and his team tragically died. The importance of extreme preparedness holds true for us in business. In fact, this example is used by Jim Collins and Morten Hansen to demonstrate why some companies have thrived under extreme and difficult circumstances while others have not. In filtering out 7 companies from 20,400, the authors found that the ones that executed most successfully did not have any better ability to predict the future than their less successful counterparts. Instead, they were the ones who acknowledged they could not predict the unexpected and therefore prepared better. Add 50% to your time estimate. I know someone who always thinks it will take her 5 minutes to get to the store because she made the journey in 5 minutes once. The truth is, it usually takes 10 to 15 minutes. In and of itself, this would not be a huge problem, but unfortunately, it is typical of most of her estimations in life. As a result, she is perennially late, and, to make matters worse, in a constant state of stress and guilt about it. She has been stuck in this cycle for so many years, she no longer even recognizes that she lives in constant stress. It has even affected her physically, but she still continues to believe she can make it to the store in 5 minutes, or finish the conference call in half an hour, or the major report in a week, or whatever else she is trying to squeeze in. And every once in a while, she does. But the costs are high to her and the people around her. She would make a far greater contribution on all these rushed endeavors if she were simply to create a buffer. Have you ever underestimated how long a task will take? If you have, you are far from alone. The term for this very common phenomenon is the planning fallacy. This term, coined by Daniel Kahneman in 1979, refers to people's tendency to underestimate how long a task will take, even when they have actually done the task before. In one study, 37 students were asked how long they thought it would take them to complete their senior thesis. When the students were asked to estimate how long it would take, if everything went as well as it possibly could, their averaged estimate was 27.4 days. When they were asked how long it would take if everything went as poorly as it possibly could, their average estimate was 48.6 days. In the end, the average time it actually took the students was 55.5 days. Only 30% of the students completed the task in the time they had estimated. Curiously, people will admit to having a tendency to underestimate while simultaneously believing their current estimates are accurate. Of the variety of explanations for why we underestimate the amount of time something will take, I believe social pressure is the most interesting. One study found that if people estimated anonymously how long it would take to complete a task, they were no longer guilty of the planning fallacy. This implies that often we actually know we can't do things in a given time frame, but we don't want to admit it to someone. Whatever the reasons, the result is that we tend to be later than we say we will be. Later to meetings, later to deliver things at work, later in paying our bills, and so on. Thus, execution becomes frustrating when it could have been frictionless. One way to protect against this is simply to add a 50% buffer to the amount of time we estimate it will take to complete a task or project. If 50% seems overly generous, consider how frequently things actually do take us 50% longer than expected. So if you have an hour set aside for a conference call, block off an additional 30 minutes. If you've estimated it will take 10 minutes to get your son to soccer practice, leave the house 15 minutes before practice begins. Not only does this relieve the stress we feel about being late, imagine how much less stressful sitting in traffic would feel if we weren't running late, but if we do find that the task was faster and easier to execute than we expected, though this is a rare experience for most of us, the extra found time feels like a bonus. Conduct scenario planning. Erwin Michel Cajon, the managing director of the Risk Management and Decision Process Center at Wharton, recommends that everyone, starting with heads of state, develop a risk management strategy. For example, he has worked in connection with the World Bank to identify the most vulnerable countries in the world. And as a result, Morocco, identified as number 58 out of the 85, has an action plan to prepare against areas of risk. When Erwin works with national governments to create their risk management strategies, he suggests they start by asking 5 questions. 1. What risks do we face and where? 2. What assets and populations are exposed and to what degree? 3. How vulnerable are they? 4. What financial burden do these risks place on individuals, businesses, and the government budget? And 5. How can you invest to reduce risks or strengthen financial or social resilience? Your answer to that 5th and crucial question will point you to buffers, perhaps adding another 20% to the project's budget, or getting a PR person on board to handle any potential negative press, or calling a board meeting to manage shareholder expectations that you can create to safeguard you against unknowable events. Essentialists accept the reality that we can never fully anticipate or prepare for every scenario or eventuality. The future is simply too unpredictable. Instead, they build in buffers to reduce the friction caused by the unexpected. Chapter 16. Subtract. Bring forth more by removing obstacles. To attain knowledge, add things every day. To attain wisdom, subtract things every day. Lao Tzu. In the business parable, The Goal, Alex Rogo is a fictional character who is overwhelmed by the responsibility of turning around a failing production plant within 3 months. At first, he does not see how this is possible. Then he is mentored by a professor who tells him he can make incredible progress in a short time if only he can find the plant's constraints. Constraints, he is told, are the obstacles holding the whole system back. Even if he improves everything else in the plant, his mentor tells him, if he doesn't address the constraints, the plant will not materially improve. As Alex is trying to make sense of what he is being taught, he goes on a hike with his son and some other friends. As the scout leader, it's his responsibility to get all of the boys to the campsite before the sun sets. But as anyone who has been on such a hike knows, getting a group of young boys to keep up a pace is more difficult than it sounds, and Alex soon runs into a problem. Some of the scouts go really fast and others go really slow. One boy in particular, Herbie, is the slowest of all. The result is that the gap between the hikers at the front of the line and Herbie, the straggler, grows to be miles long. At first, Alex tries to manage the problem by getting the group at the front to stop and wait for the others to catch up. This keeps the group together for a time, but the moment they start walking again, the same gap begins to form all over again. So Alex decides to try a different approach. He puts Herbie at the front of the pack and lines up all the other boys in order of speed, slowest to fastest. It's counterintuitive to have the fastest person at the back of the line, but the moment he does it, the pack begins to move in a single group. Every boy can keep up with the boy in front of him. The upside is that he can now keep an eye on the whole group at once, and they will all arrive at the campsite safely and at the same time. The downside is that the whole troop is now moving at Herbie's pace, so they will arrive late. So what should he do? The answer, Alex finds, is to do anything and everything to make things easier for Herbie. With the slowest boy at the front of the line, if Herbie moves 1 yard an hour faster, the whole troop will get there that much faster. That is an amazing insight, Alex. Any improvement with Herbie, however small, will improve the pace of the whole team immediately. So he actually takes weight out from Herbie's backpack, the extra food and supplies he brought with him, and distributes it throughout the rest of the group. And indeed, this instantly improves the speed of the whole group. They make it to camp in good time. In a moment of insight, Alex sees how this approach could also be applied to turning around his production plant. Instead of trying to improve every aspect of the facility, he needs to identify the Herbie, the part of the process that is slower relative to every other part of the plant. He does this by finding which machine has the biggest queue of materials waiting behind it, and finds a way to increase its efficiency. This in turn improves the next slowest hiker's efficiency, and so on, until the productivity of the whole plant begins to improve. The question is this: what is the slowest hiker in your job or your life? What is the obstacle that is keeping you back from achieving what really matters to you? By systematically identifying and removing this constraint, you'll be able to significantly reduce the friction keeping you from executing what is essential. But this can't be done in a haphazard way. Simply finding things that need fixing here and there might lead to marginal short-term improvements at best. At worst, you'll waste time and effort improving things that don't really matter. But if you really want to improve the overall functioning of the system, whether that system is a manufacturing process, a procedure in your department, or some routine in your daily life, you need to identify the slowest hiker. A non-essentialist approaches execution in a reactive, haphazard manner. Because the non-essentialist is always reacting to crises rather than anticipating them, he is forced to apply quick-fix solutions, the equivalent to plugging his finger into the hole of a leaking dam and hoping the whole thing doesn't burst. Being good with a hammer, the non-essentialist thinks everything is a nail. Thus he applies more and more pressure, but this ends up only adding more friction and frustration. Indeed, in some situations, the harder you push on someone, the harder he or she will push back. Essentialists don't default to band-aid solutions. Instead of looking for the most obvious or immediate obstacles, they look for the ones slowing down progress. They ask, what is getting in the way of achieving what is essential? While the non-essentialist is busy applying more and more pressure and piling on more and more solutions, the essentialist simply makes a one-time investment in removing obstacles. This approach goes beyond just solving problems. It's a method of reducing your efforts to maximize your results. A non-essentialist piles on quick-fix solutions. An essentialist removes obstacles to progress. A non-essentialist does more. An essentialist brings forth more. Produce more by removing more. Aristotle talked about three kinds of work, whereas in our modern world, we tend to emphasize only two. The first is theoretical work, for which the end goal is truth. The second is practical work, where the objective is action. But there is a third. It is poietical work. The philosopher Martin Heidegger described poiesis as a bringing forth. This third type of work is the essentialist way of approaching execution. An essentialist produces more, brings forth more, by removing more instead of doing more. Often we don't take the time to really think about which efforts will produce results and which will not. But even when we do, it is easier to think of execution in terms of addition rather than subtraction. If we want to sell more products, then we get more salespeople. If we want to produce more output, then we ramp up production. There is clearly evidence to support this approach. However, there is another way to think of improving results. Instead of focusing on the efforts and resources we need to add, the essentialist focuses on the constraints or obstacles we need to remove. But how? 1. Be clear about the essential intent. We can't know what obstacles to remove until we are clear on the desired outcome. When we don't know what we're really trying to achieve, all change is arbitrary. So ask yourself, how will we know when we are done? For the purposes of this chapter, let's say your goal is to get a draft of a 15-page written report attached to an email and sent to the client by 2 p.m. on Thursday. Note, this is deliberately a precise outcome, not a vague one. 2. Identify the slowest hiker. Instead of just jumping into the project, take a few minutes to think. Ask yourself, what are all the obstacles standing between me and getting this done? And what is keeping me from completing this? Make a list of these obstacles. They might include not having the information you need, your energy level, your desire for perfection. Prioritize the list using the question, what is the obstacle that, if removed, would make the majority of other obstacles disappear? When identifying your slowest hiker, one important thing to keep in mind is that even activities that are productive, like doing research, or emailing people for information, or rewriting the report in order to get it perfect the first time around, can be obstacles. Remember, the desired goal is to get a draft of the report finished. Anything slowing down the execution of that goal should be questioned. There are often multiple obstacles to achieving any essential intent. However, at any one time, there is only ever one priority. Removing arbitrary obstacles can have no effect whatsoever if the primary one still doesn't budge. To take our example, if getting words on the page is your primary obstacle, you could hire someone to do research for you and still be no closer to writing the aforementioned report. So just as Alex fixes the least efficient machine first, followed by the second least efficient, and so on, instead of trying to fix them all at once, we too must tackle the removal of obstacles one by one. 3. Remove the obstacle. Let's say your slowest hiker turns out to be your desire to make the report perfect. There may be dozens of ideas you have to make the report better, but in this case, your essential intent is to send off the draft. So to remove the obstacle, you need to replace the idea, "This has to be perfect or else," with "Done is better than perfect." Give yourself permission to not have it polished in the first draft. By removing the primary obstacle, you have made every other aspect of the job easier. The slowest hiker could even be another person, whether it's a boss who won't give the green light on a project, the finance department who won't approve the budget, or a client who won't sign on the dotted line. To reduce the friction with another person, apply the catch more flies with honey approach. Send him an email, but instead of asking if he has done the work for you, which obviously he hasn't, go and see him. Ask him, what obstacles or bottlenecks are holding you back from achieving X, and how can I help remove these? Instead of pestering him, offer sincerely to support him. You will get a warmer reply than you would by just emailing him another demand. When our children were really little and I was at graduate school, my wife was feeling strained by the demands of looking after the children all day, every day, and didn't know quite what to do about it. I was reading about the theory of constraints at the time, so it was particularly on my mind. As we applied the steps above, we realized the primary obstacle keeping her from making her highest point of contribution in our children's lives was a lack of time to plan, think, and prepare. After all, with three little children, it was nearly impossible to have uninterrupted time. So we worked to remove this obstacle. I opted out of many of the extracurricular activities to be home in the evenings, and we found someone who would look after the children for a few hours during the week. As a result, we were able to be more fully engaged and present during the time we spent with our children. In other words, we both actually ended up doing less but better. Removing obstacles doesn't have to be hard or take a superhuman effort. Instead, we can start small. It's kind of like dislodging a boulder at the top of a hill. All it takes is a small shove, then momentum will naturally build. Chapter 17. Progress. The power of small wins. Every day, do something that will inch you closer to a better tomorrow. Doug Feuerbach. Think of the last time you were pulled over by the police while driving. Did you wonder to yourself, Is this going to be a good ticket or a bad one? Not likely. Everyone knows tickets are all bad, right? Yet at least one innovative police precinct in Richmond, Canada, thinks this is an assumption that ought to be challenged. There is a well-established approach to cracking down on crime. Pass new and harsher laws, set stronger sentencing, or initiate zero-tolerance initiatives. In other words, do more of what we already do, only more forcefully. For years, the Richmond Police Department followed these core and long-held practices of policing systems everywhere and experienced the typical results: recidivism rates at 65% and spiraling youth crime. That is, until a young, forward-thinking new superintendent, Ward Clapham, came in and challenged them. Why, he asked, do all of our policing efforts have to be so reactive, so negative, and so after the fact? What if, instead of just focusing on catching criminals and serving up ever harsher punishments after they committed the crime, the police devoted significant resources and effort to eliminating criminal behavior before it happens? To quote Tony Blair, what if they could be tough on crime but also tough on the causes of crime? Out of these questions came the novel idea for Positive Tickets, a program whereby police, instead of focusing on catching young people perpetrating crimes, would focus on catching youth doing something good, something as simple as throwing litter away in a bin rather than on the ground, wearing a helmet while riding their bike, skateboarding in the designated area, or getting to school on time, and would give them a ticket for positive behavior. The ticket, of course, wouldn't carry a fine like a parking ticket, but instead would be redeemable for some kind of small reward, like free entry to the movies, or to an event at a local youth center. Wholesome activities that also had the bonus of keeping the young people off the streets and out of trouble. So how well did Richmond's unconventional effort to reimagine policing work? Amazingly well, as it turned out. It took some time, but they invested in the approach as a long-term strategy, and after a decade, the positive ticket system had reduced recidivism from 60% to 8%. You might not think of a police department as a place where you would expect to see essentialism at work, but in fact, Ward's system of positive tickets is a lesson in the practice of effortless execution. The way of the non-essentialist is to go big on everything, to try to do it all, have it all, fit it all in. The non-essentialist operates under the false logic that the more he strives, the more he will achieve. But the reality is, the more we reach for the stars, the harder it is to get ourselves off the ground. The way of the essentialist is different. Instead of trying to accomplish it all, and all at once, and flaring out, the essentialist starts small and celebrates progress. Instead of going for the big, flashy wins that don't really matter, the essentialist pursues small and simple wins in areas that are essential. A non-essentialist starts with a big goal and gets small results. An essentialist starts small and gets big results. A non-essentialist goes for the flashiest wins. An essentialist celebrates small acts of progress. By catching and rewarding people in the midst of small wins, Ward Clapham's approach tapped into the power of celebrating progress. In one moving example, a police officer pulled over a teenager who had saved a girl from being hit by a car, gave him a positive ticket and said, "You did a great thing today. You can make a difference." The boy went home and put the positive ticket on his wall. After a few weeks, his foster mother asked him whether he was going to cash it in. To her surprise, he said he never would. An adult had told him he could be somebody, and that was worth more than free pizza or bowling. Multiply that type of positive interaction by 40,000 times a year for 10 years, and you can sense why it started to make a difference. Each time a young person was recognized and commended for doing something good, he or she was that much more motivated to continue doing good until eventually doing good became natural and effortless. When we want to create major change, we often think we need to lead with something huge or grandiose, like the executive I knew who announced with great fanfare that that he had decided to build his daughters an elaborate dollhouse. But then, because his visions for it were so large and ambitious, abandoned the project as too burdensome. There is an appealing logic to this, that to do something big, we have to start big. However, just think of all of the big, hyped-up initiatives in organizations that never ended up amounting to anything, just like that executive's dollhouse. Research has shown that of all forms of human motivation, the most effective one is progress. Why? Because a small, concrete win creates momentum and affirms our faith in our further success. In his 1968 Harvard Business Review article entitled, One More Time, How Do You Motivate Employees? Among the most popular Harvard Business Review articles of all time, Frederick Hertzberg reveals research showing that the two primary internal motivators for people are achievement and recognition for achievement. More recently, Teresa Amabile and Stephen Kramer gathered anonymous diary entries from hundreds of people and covering thousands of workdays. On the basis of these hundreds of thousands of reflections, Amabile and Kramer concluded that everyday progress, even a small win, can make all the difference in how people feel and perform. Of all the things that can boost emotions, motivation, and perceptions during a workday, the single most important is making progress in meaningful work, they said. Instead of starting big and then flaring out, with nothing to show for it other than time and energy wasted, to really get essential things done, we need to start small and build momentum. Then we can use that momentum to work toward the next win, and the next one, and so on, until we have a significant breakthrough. And when we do, our progress will have become so frictionless and effortless that the breakthrough will seem like overnight success. As former Stanford professor and educator Henry B. Eyring has written, my experience has taught me this about how people and organizations improve. The best place to look is for small changes we could make in the things we do often. There is power in steadiness and repetition. When I met Dr. Phil Zimbardo, the former president of the American Psychological Association, for lunch, I knew him primarily as the mastermind behind the famous Stanford Prison Experiment. In the summer of 1971, Zimbardo took healthy Stanford students, assigned them roles as either guards or inmates, and locked them in a makeshift prison, in the basement of Stanford University. In just days, the prisoners began to demonstrate symptoms of depression and extreme stress, while the guards began to act cruel and sadistic. The experiment was ended early for obvious reasons. The point is that simply being treated like prisoners and guards had, over the course of just a few days, created a momentum that caused the subjects to act like prisoners and guards. The Stanford Prison Experiment is legendary, and much has been written about its many implications. But what I wondered was this. If simply being treated in a certain way conditioned these Stanford students to gradually adopt these negative behaviors, could the same kind of conditioning work for more positive behavior too? Indeed, today Zimbardo is attempting a grand social experiment along those lines called the Heroic Imagination Project. The logic is to increase the odds of people operating with courage by teaching them the principles of heroism. By encouraging and rewarding heroic acts, Zimbardo believes we can consciously and deliberately create a system where heroic acts eventually become natural and effortless. We have a choice. We can use our energies to set up a system that makes execution of goodness easy, or we can resign ourselves to a system that actually makes it harder to do what is good. Ward's positive ticket system did the former, and it worked. We can apply the same principle to the choices we face when designing systems in our own lives. My wife Anna and I tried to apply these ideas to our system of parenting. At one point, we had become concerned with how much screen time had crept into our family. Between television, computers, tablets, and smartphones, it had become just too easy for the children to waste time on non-essential entertainment. But our attempts to get them to change these habits, as you can imagine, were met with friction. The children would complain whenever we turned the TV off or tried to limit their screen time. And we as the parents had to consciously police the situation, which took us away from doing things that were essential. So we introduced a token system. The children were given 10 tokens at the beginning of the week. These could each be traded in for either 30 minutes of screen time or 50 cents at the end of the week, adding up to $5 or 5 hours of screen time a week. If a child read a book for 30 minutes, he or she would earn an additional token, which could also be traded in for screen time or for money. The results were incredible. Overnight, screen time went down 90%. Reading went up by the same amount, and the overall effort we had to put into policing the system went way, way down. In other words, non-essential activity dramatically decreased, and essential activity dramatically increased. Once a small amount of initial effort was invested to set up the system, it worked without friction. We can all create systems like this, both at home and at work. The key is to start small, encourage progress, and celebrate small wins. Here are a few techniques. Focus on minimal viable progress. A popular idea in Silicon Valley is done is better than perfect. The sentiment is not that we should produce rubbish. The idea, as I read it, is not to waste time on non-essentials and just to get the thing done. In entrepreneurial circles, the idea is expressed as creating a minimal viable product. The idea is, what is the simplest possible product that will be useful and valuable to the intended customer? Similarly, we can adopt a method of minimal viable progress. We can ask ourselves, what is the smallest amount of progress that will be useful and valuable to the essential task we are trying to get done? I used this practice in writing this book. For example, when I was still in the exploratory mode of the book, before I'd even begun to put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, I would share a short idea, my minimal viable product, on Twitter. If it seemed to resonate with people there, I would write a blog piece on Harvard Business Review. Through this iterative process, which required very little effort, I was able to find where there seemed to be a connection between what I was thinking and what seemed to have the highest relevancy in other people's lives. It is the process Pixar uses on their movies. Instead of starting with a script, they start with storyboards, or what have been described as the comic book version of a movie. They try ideas out and see what works. They do this in small cycles hundreds of times. Then they put out a movie to small groups of people to give them advance feedback. This allows them to learn as quickly as possible with as little effort as possible. As John Lasseter, the chief creative officer at Pixar and now Disney, said, "We don't actually finish our films, we release them." Do the minimal viable preparation. There are two opposing ways to approach an important goal or deadline. You can start early and small, or start late and big. Late and big means doing it all at the last minute, pulling an all-nighter and making it happen. Early and small means starting at the earliest possible moment with the minimal possible time investment. Often just 10 minutes invested in a project or assignment 2 weeks before it is due can save you much frantic and stressed out scrambling at the 11th hour. Take a goal or deadline you have coming up and ask yourself, what is the minimal amount I could do right now to prepare? One leader who is an exceptionally inspiring speaker has explained that the key for him is to start to prepare his big speeches 6 months before he does them. He isn't preparing the entire speech, he just starts. If you have a big presentation coming up over the next few weeks or months, open a file right now and spend 4 minutes starting to put down any ideas. Then close the file. No more than 4 minutes, just start it. A colleague in New York uses a simple hack. Whenever she schedules a meeting or phone call, she takes exactly 15 seconds to type up the main objectives for that meeting. So on the morning of the meeting, when she sits down to prepare talking points, she can refer to them. She doesn't need to plan the whole meeting agenda. Just a few seconds of early preparation pay a valuable dividend. Visually reward progress. Do you remember when you were 5 years old and your school held a fundraiser? Remember the big thermometer that visually showed the progress the school was making toward the goal? Can you remember how exciting and motivating it was to watch the level of the thermometer go up each day? Or perhaps your parents had a star chart for you. Every time you ate your spinach, or went to bed on time, or cleaned your room, you got a star. And pretty soon you were doing those things virtually without any prodding. There is something powerful about visibly seeing progress toward a goal. Don't be above applying the same technique to your own essential goals, at home or at work. When we start small and reward progress, we end up achieving more than when we set big, lofty, and often impossible goals. And as a bonus, the act of positively reinforcing our successes allows us to reap more enjoyment and satisfaction out of the process.